This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to Nomads Past and Present, a podcast about nomadism and nomadic peoples around the world and throughout history. I'm your host, Maggie Freeman, and my guest today is Dr. Amelia Lefebvre. Amelia is an anthropologist of photography, history, and digital practices. Her book, Photography and Making Bedouin Histories in the Negev, which was recently published by Routledge, examines photographic archives of the Bedouin in the Negev Desert. And that's what we'll be talking about today. So thank you so much for joining me.
Hello, Maggie, and thank you very much for having me.
So your book covers the period 1906 to 2013 with the 1948 Nakba and formation of the State of Israel as the halfway point of that chronological period. And 1948 also seems to represent a turning point in how the Negev Bedouin that you researched use and relate to photography. So in earlier periods, they're more likely to be the kind of quote unquote passive subjects of photographs by outsiders and to rarely have access to photographic equipment or to the photographs that were made of them. And then post-1948, this changes as the Bedouins start to actively take and collect photographs as a means of proving things like land ownership and residence and family ties, which are all kind of necessary tools for survival within the Israeli state. So how do these photographs of the Negev Bedouin change in terms of, you know, their content, the things or the people that are being photographed, the quantity of photographs taken, photographic technologies, how those photographs are stored and disseminated? How do those things change as their authorship and their use as a political tool also changes along this sort of 100-year period?
Well, that's a very good question. And I'm going to go ahead and apologize for what might be an overly long response. As you suggested in your question, Bedouin relationships to photography of their society and history have changed over the centuries. I address this particular topic in chapter 3 of the book, which provides kind of a loose historiography of Negev Bedouin photography. There, I discuss the broader ideological and iconographic context, such as Orientalism, colonialism, and nationalism, along with more localized tribal, civic, and family-based discourses that influence not only the making, but also the consumption of photographs of Negev Bedouin among members and outsiders alike. These processes have created specific photographic genres, which include cartes de visite, portraits, ID photographs, family photos, school pictures, and tourist images, for example. Additionally, the economic organization or technological qualities of these photographs and their viewings are also aspects that influence the relationship between photography and history. At the end of the 19th century, for For instance, many images of the Bedouin and the Naqab took the form of stereographs. During the mid-20th century, we have more black and white film and paper photographs. At the turn of the 21st century, most images are now some form of digital code. Throughout this time, images have been stored in a vast range of locations. These range from international and regional state archives, academic storage places, and the Naqab, they're collected in plastic bags and sometimes laid out in albums. In addition to their diverse storage practices, these photographs have also been consumed by a wide range of insiders and outsiders throughout the centuries. These can include tourist albums created in the 19th century to mid-century magazines and newspapers. In the 21st century, however, the consumption of images has significantly increased, mainly because of the internet and mobile phones. So now images can more easily cross in the international language and physical borders and travel outside of institutional archives and then into people's homes. Images of the Naqab Bedouin have also been created by a wide range of people, each having their own respective photographic practices and access to the technology. For instance, the earliest photographs of the Naqab Bedouin were created in the 1900s by professional photographers such as John Whiting. He was associated with the American Colony's photography department located in Jerusalem, who were some of the first to have photographic equipment in the region. In the mid-20th century, cameras and darkroom equipment became more readily available. And so you have more lay and professional photographers being able to work, especially during the war periods. After 1948, this is when you begin to see Bedouin members themselves, particularly from wealthy families, starting to commission and take photographs, particularly within their own lineages. This leads us up to today, where during fieldwork, I found that almost everyone I met over the age of 14 had some access to a phone camera. And with these phones and the internet, members can now take their own images, they share them with whomever, and they also can access photos via their phones of their ancestors through Google searches, Wikipedia, what have you. And this brings me back to your question with regard to Bedouin members being passive or active photographic agents. All of the images of the Naqab Bedouin created over the last century involved the active participation of members. This is very similar to what Nicole Strantham demonstrated with American Indian photography, that Bedouin were and still are agents in the creation of photographs depicting their history and society. This is whether they were the local photographer, whether they were sitters, collaborators, or background figures. Bedouin experiences are therefore always inscribed on these images, despite the fact that both the production and the consumption of most of these photographs involve profound asymmetrical power relations. For example, in most cases, the names of photographed Bedouin members were never recorded. They were lost to time, disregarded, or simply deemed unimportant by the image producers. Alternatively, the subjects were chosen by the photographers either out of opportunity or selected because they represented some kind of particular ideas of Bedouinism in their for their prospective audiences. These could range from overlapping Western stereotypes about Bedouin biblical imagery to Palestinian or Israeli views of Bedouin nomadicism, and also include members' own notions such as honor, modesty, kinship. Notwithstanding, the presence of the image subjects remain inscribed on the photographs. And thus, these archival images hold an innate potential. And I'm using the words here of Ariella Azulay, that they have the potential to be re-inscribed with local knowledge by Bedouin members themselves. To wrap up, as Tina Camp, who's worked really admire her work among Black Europeans, she demonstrated that photography offers people a medium to recreate visualizations of themselves. Similarly, I argued that the Bedouin use photographs in ways that mirror their own identities, but also varied ideas of history. Again, these practices are becoming more frequent because of the advent of the internet and digital technology. What's key here is that these developments are also democratizing institutional archives and official historiographies, which relied on resources that were notoriously hard to access. These 21st century Technologies in the form of computers, cameras, printers have augmented access to archival photographs and then amplifying their kind of historical reconnaissance outside of the urban Middle East. This is the process that's providing people like Bedouin and the Naka more opportunities to reread stereotypical or maybe state images of themselves. And in doing that, they often treat them as evidential sources, but also very versatile types of documents that can be reinscribed with layers or local knowledge.
And
I hope that answered your question.
It more than did, yes. to maybe situate listeners a little bit more in the temporal and geographical context of your research, could you talk a little bit about what, if anything, sort of makes photography of the Nekka Bedouin, maybe particularly in the earlier period of your research, in the late Ottoman period, the British Mandate period, how did photography of the Nekka Bedouin specifically differ from photography of Arab citizens of other parts of Palestine? For example, you know, how was photography of the Bedouin different from photography in Jerusalem, for example? If when John Whiting and other members of the American colony were photographing the region, how was the Negev and the inhabitants of it conceived and photographed differently than urban areas of Palestine? You know, you mentioned that the kind of the nomadism, whether real or imagined, of the Bedouin was kind of a particular concern for photographers and for governments. But were there other things that photographers were sort of particularly interested in capturing in this landscape? Or were there other sort of particular images of the Bedouin that they were interested in putting forward in kind of differentiating the Bedouin from urban or settled inhabitants of Palestine?
Well, in my research of earliest photographs of the Nakba Bedouin, as I mentioned earlier, they were from the American colony, which opened up their photography department. It was at the turn of the century, and they were some of the first to take any photographs of the region. And you had a range of photographers working for them. You had Elijah Myers, John Whiting, and particularly Whiting had a very close relationship with Bedouin communities outside of Jerusalem, especially in the Naqab. You can find his diaries in the Library of Congress that speaks to this relationship that he had with them. He also, though, held very Orientalist views of the population based on these kind of romanticized stereotypes of biblical imagery, that the Bedouin really, you know, represented this idea of biblical times. One relationship I was really always particularly interested in and would love to do more research is John Whiting's relationship with Atef at Atef. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he, along with his relationship with Whiting, took some of the first photographs of the Bedouin sheikhs and landscape of Bershever region, but also his writings are very important to Nakba Bedouin members even up until today. He was the district officer during British Mandate Bersheba between 1933 and 1948. He was a Palestinian man originally from Jerusalem who, as I mentioned, extensively wrote about Bedouin society during his administration. These writings accumulated in a series of books that recorded Bedouin genealogies, territories, and customs. But he also, I believe, commissioned John Whiting to come to Beersheba, and they set up a series of photographic studio images where you have big groups of sheikhs, mostly representing each of the tribal confederations. He then, in some of his publications, took those group images and cut out each of the portraits and put it in his book on history of the Bedouin tribes, which was written in Arabic. And Atef at Atef went through and actually named all the tribes. Now, this was the case with his writings in Arabic. kind of reflecting John Whiting's more Orientalist views, Arif Radov also wrote a couple books, I believe in German and in English. One's Bedouin Love, Law, and Language. And in that book, it's a very Orientalist presentation of the Bedouin, especially utilizing the reputation of Sheikh Al-Huzail. And even the use of photographs represents this very Western European view of the Bedouin. So I don't know if that...
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Yeah, and that leads me into my next question, which is about basically the ethics of using this particular body of sources. And this is a topic that comes up in virtually every interview I've done for this podcast, which is that of sources and the particular ethics and politics and pitfalls of sources for histories of nomadic peoples. And there's a widespread perception that nomadic peoples are difficult to locate in the sources that are commonly used by historians, that they rarely produce their own written histories or documentary records, and that they're sort of by definition equally difficult to locate in the material record. And where sources, especially written ones on nomadic peoples, do exist, they're often produced by outsiders. And therefore, historians have to account for these kind of potential implicit biases on the part of the author. So what do these challenges look like when dealing with photographic archives specifically? When looking at photographs of the Negev Bedouin, especially these ones that you've talked about that are taken by outsiders that are bringing their kind of Orientalism, their biases, their preconceived notions of the Bedouin into the photographic studio with them, what potential biases or problems created by the photographic gaze do you have to take into consideration?
Okay, very good question. So about potential explicit bias, I'm going to start first with writings, because a lot of the photographs that the Bedouin value or consider historically significant in our own society come from books. They're images that they found in a library or someone gave them, and they've cut them out of the book and hung them up on the wall of the Shig or have them in an album. In addition to Arif Al-Adif's work, was one of the most important writings about the Naqab Bedouin in the mid-20th century was by Emmanuel Marx, who was a social anthropologist, I believe from Manchester, or went to University of Manchester. He was also Israeli, and he was conducting field work right after the Nakba. Let's see here. Yeah, it was right after 1948, during what this period of time in Israel was called the military administration, which lasted until about the 1990s. His work came at a time when the region of southern Palestine was officially named the Negev by the state of Israel. And by the end of the 1960s, the state had started to officially refer to Bedouin around Beersheba as Bedouin of the Negev, which is the title of his ethnography. As part of his field work, he took quite a few photographs, and these can be found in the book. Critics argue that his early ethnographic scholarship, it was regularly used by the state of Israel and by Israeli media to kind of help them create this new geopolitical identity and to help them establish these borders. And over the last the next decades, Marx's ethnographies, particularly for Israeli readers, became less of a study about Bedouin tribal culture and more about documenting Bedouin primitivism and nomadicism as compared to the urban Israeli citizens. As far as, like I said, the photographs sit alongside inside these books, and so they carry the same potential biases. And I do believe that post-colonial critiques, especially in visual cultural studies, since the 1990s and early 2000s, have done a very good job critiquing Orientalist writings and photographs and image making and sense of deconstructing the power hierarchies and shedding light on the problematic colonial gazes that these photographs have, you know, stereotyped Bedouin societies throughout the Middle East. However, with my book, I'm joining a new conversation called The Cultural Turn, our studies of the cultural turn of photography, where at the end of the day, photographs are dynamic and they're very disruptive historical resources. This comes largely in part as images, and this might be a little too philosophical, do not actually have inherent meaning. Instead, they're representations, and these representations have to be interpreted. And these can change within any context, and they're largely in the context in which they're used and valued. And as we study this, we realize that these practices are often determined by the cultures in which we live. In this regard, scholars have increasingly set out, particularly in the Middle East right now, to document how people outside the Western world are reinterpreting and reinscribing local knowledge on these old colonial photographs in places such as the Naqab. Therefore, in a lot of sense, my research was less concerned about deconstructing the Orientalist gaze or state relations on these images, but I was more interested in asking why the Bedouin themselves value what are often these very stereotypical images of themselves, and what kind of historical knowledge do they relate to by viewing these photographs, and then what type of knowledge are they inscribing on them, particularly images of their ancestors.
And so, what do you think that value is? You know, we've already touched on this a little bit about the kind of political utility of photographs as kind of proof in the Israeli context, within the Israeli legal system, you know, being able to prove things like land ownership, being able to prove things like historical presence, things like that. Are there more forms of value that these images connote to the Naqab Bedouin beyond that kind of almost kind of utilitarian value?
It was one thing I was demonstrating in the book. I discussed this idea of entangled visual economies, the idea that the representational landscape of the Naqab is very complex. You have geopolitical, international stereotypes, like we were talking Orientalist views coming from the West. Then you have these fraught nationalisms between Israelism and Palestinianism. And then you have Naqab Bedouin society themselves, which is a heterogeneous, complex society that has different classes. And then you get the internal politics inside lineages. And then you get, you know, basic family politics. And at each layer, you would have the history work that photographs do was related, but a little bit different. So with what I call the macro Palestinian-Israeli nationalism, this is where you find Bedouin using images to evidence their land claims, particularly in courts or in the media. But that same image within the more inside Bedouin society, you would find that image taped up in the Shig, and it was an example to show the status and the longevity and the power of this particular lineage as compared and in competition to other lineages. And therefore, that photograph becomes part of their very specific tribal historical narrative while relating to the broader history in this specific context. And then it could go even further that family can therefore justify their status within their lineage of why, say, the Kabir, the elders come from there, or the Sheikh, and proves this longevity of history. And so that was one thing I was trying to ascertain, is these photographs could be read very differently and were. When I was interviewing people, the narratives often changed, but I realized it was pretty consistent with who they were directing these historical narratives and how they were using them as evidence.
Mm-hmm. One of the other maybe sort of ethical questions that comes up in your book is a discussion of the gender norms among the Naqab Bedouin around women and photography. So for example, the requirement that Palestinians and Israelis carry photo ID cards, despite the kind of traditional taboo on Bedouin women showing their faces. So how were some of these cultural attitudes toward photographing Bedouin women dealt with during the earlier generations of photography in the Negev? And then how have they changed more recently?
Well, I can't really speak to how they were in the past because I was interviewing contemporary Bedouin. I did find that contemporary attitudes towards photographing and photographs of women varied on a variety, depended on a variety of facts, one of which was the age of the photograph, the name and the status of the woman imaged, whether her face could be seen or not, the context in which the image was being used, and then the range of its potential circulation. So first, the age of the photograph mattered. The older photographs, there appeared to be less restrictions by members put on them. And I think this largely had to do because the names, the women's names, lineages, and status really couldn't be determined from the photograph because these things weren't simply recorded at the time or never listed in captions, or there weren't text associated with the image that named them. The second issue for contemporary Bedouin women were issues of morality, honor, and status. Associated women are very important, and it's an important way members establish their own and their family's reputations and their place in local hierarchies. One way this is communicated is through veiling or showing one's face, and that regulation outside of one's kin group. So photographs in this way kind of replicate that practice through their imagery. And so therefore images of living women where their faces can be seen from everyone I interviewed should only be consumed by family members and not circulated outside of lineage networks because doing so would harm the reputation of the family. With that said, I did find in some situations, this was the choice for some women, particularly women who are public figures. Several women from the Elsana lineage who speak at to media, speak at different protests, particularly representing their communities or their families to international audiences. They seem to be fine with their pictures having their photographs being taken and circulated. But as I said, these are very specific public spaces when this happens. And I would argue also they do so with the support of their family members.
Yeah. So in light of these kind of cultural norms that you just touched on, or these very sort of nuanced norms around in what context photographs, especially of women, can be circulated and to whom. Is there any sense among your informants and interviewees that they should have more sort of direct agency and control over what photographs, maybe both historical and contemporary, what photographs of their community are available and to whom? I think this is an increasingly large and relevant sort of ethical discussion in institutions like museums and archives in other colonial contexts, like in the United States and Canada and Australia. There's a sort of increasing awareness of cultural norms towards photography among Indigenous peoples and a growing trend towards removing or restricting from view photographs of Indigenous peoples that might have been taken under duress or that the subjects of the of those photographs would not necessarily have wanted to be sort of widely available or publicly disseminated. Is there any sort of sense of that happening among the Negev Bedouin, an increasing sense of sort of, these photographs are of us, they belong to us, and therefore we should have more say over how photographs of the Negev Bedouin that are held in the Library of Congress, for example, more say over how those photographs are used and stored and things like that? Or does the kind of political power of photographs and of representations of the Negev Bedouin, you know, within the context of the Israeli state, does that sort of outweigh any of their potentially problematic nature?
So I'm going to answer that in two parts.
It's a two-part question.
The first part, I'm going to speak a bit more about the contemporary photographs of particularly outsiders coming into the Naqab and taking photographs, and then taking those photographs, publishing articles about them, showing them in exhibitions in Europe or what have you. I do think that members are becoming increasingly aware that these photographs are being seen outside of the Naqab and what that means. And so my host family were very particular when we were there that we could take as many photographs as we wanted, but if we were going to, if I was going to publish or do an exhibition, please remove the faces of the women, and the children not as much, which is an interesting, I don't know, rabbit hole. I wish I had done a little bit more research. I don't know what was due to the status of children. I found a lot of nonprofits were coming in and doing these projects with children, which they'd give cameras, they'd give them cameras and they would go around and take images. And then the nonprofit would then do exhibitions. And a lot of times the children's faces, both boys and girls, would be shown. As far as ethics, I tried to follow what my host family had asked of me. It's rather strict about it. As far as archival photographs. I wrote about this issue in an article with History and Anthropology. And the short answer is yes. Most people I interviewed wanted to have more control, but more importantly, more ownership over these historical photographs, particularly of their people and when they could identify if they were associated with a particular lineage. However, what was really fascinating is which members get to have this control. Where do they get to exert this control, and when do they get to use it? This becomes extremely problematic once the photographs come from the international archives and returns back to the Naqab. Here I found that tribal, or more accurately, competition between the lineages over cultural capital often involved these archival documents, such as photographs. So, for example, in the article, I described over the course of my doctoral research, I had amassed a very large collection of historical photographs of the Naqab Bedouin, numbering in the thousands. As such, I thought I would work with a local Bedouin photographer to create a community photographic archive, wherein members could access the images and also place their knowledge onto them, name people, landscapes, events. I quickly learned that these efforts were extremely difficult, as each lineage wanted to take ownership over the collection and house the archive in their own localities where their families and tribal affiliates resided. It would have been a process that would have then restricted other lineages' access to this photographic archive. This is particularly the case with old images, and those that can be affiliated to specific tribal confederation groups or what have you. Newer images, such as those created in collaboration with media outlets, civil society organizations, and other stakeholders, tend to be less restricted because their meaning and purpose is more, like we had said earlier, directed towards political power struggles with the state of Israel. The consumption of photographs in the Naqab Bedouin outside of the region wasn't the focus of my research per se, but I would say that most people I interviewed wanted the archival images located overseas to be returned, and that was the main priority, to bring them back. And I hope that answered your question.
Yeah. Do you know if that desire for photographs to be returned, has that manifested in actual movement, in petitions, in, you know, outreach to the institutions that hold these collections? Or was this just sort of voiced to you as a, you know, this is something we would like, we think should happen, this is something we would like to happen in the future?
As of 2013, when I left and completed my field work, photographs were just starting, especially the archival photographs, were just starting to get kind of attention. And at that time, it was just through personal interviews that people are like, these, you know, these are our photographs, we need them, they're part of our history, they're not the history of the British men, or the British, they're ours. As far as any systematic attempts to collect and bring things back, I'm not aware in the last 10 years that that's happened. I am working with a nonprofit in Canada right now, run by Amal Alsana, who's a very prominent Bedouin female leader. And we're hoping to work with a couple of the lineages in different townships to create more of a systematic way to bring these archives archive of photographs back to the community. Mm-hmm. So I will see how successful we are with it, but amid everything. But yes, as far as systematic attempts, I'm not quite sure. I do know with books and things, there's been more effort, especially particular with Bedouin students and professionals and academics going overseas, getting them and bringing them back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to ask too, in light of that, if you know if that desire for kind of restitution or return of archival material related to the Bedouin also extends to documentary archives as well, because so often in my research, when I encounter photographs of the Bedouin, it's often in the context of, you know, a printed black and white photograph is just glued onto an archival document, you know. And then they're part of a larger archival written record, you know, where the caption of the photograph is handwritten on the page and it's, you know, stapled into a larger file. And so it can't really be taken out of, it can't, you know, the photograph itself cannot just simply be removed piecemeal from that larger archival context. Do you have a sense of how maybe the conversation or any sort of action around the return of photographs is related to other, you know, archival materials and the potential return or relocation of those as well?
Well, this is incredible duality that photographs have, because on one hand, they're material objects, and this whole material turn looking at, you know, culture and artifacts and how they influence our lives, photographs are very much situated in that. Alongside books, there are things to be held, to be looked at, to be taped, put into archives. And then, and so that there's that value of owning this thing and keeping it and using it as evidence for what have you. But on the other hand, with digital technologies now, we can go in with our cameras, take a digital image of this archival document where the photograph's embedded, say, on a written document, and take it back. And I found it was Lucy Rozova's work really talks about this duality of it's a material, but it's also the digital images. Actually, for most of the Bedouin that I interviewed had just as much value because the content was there, the representation was there. Obviously, I think owning the material would have been like has a little bit higher precedent, but the fact that they have a digital copy that's on their phone or on their computer had held value to them. And so I think it's interesting is this, you're finding this democratization of the archives because of digital technologies. And mm-hmm. so.
Yeah, that is really interesting that it's just sort of the access to information itself that is really the most important thing rather than the access to the physical thing or the physical or the original object. So we've been talking quite a bit about historical photographs and archival photographs and documents and things like that, but I wanted to focus also on contemporary photographs and photographic representations. You talked about this a little bit already, but I'm curious how, you know, technologies like social media, like camera phones, have changed, especially just in the past, you know, handful of years. I know you were doing your field work 10 years ago now. So I think even more has changed in terms of technology and social media since then. But so I'm curious, in that point of, in time when you were doing your field work, what you were observing in terms of how modern communications technologies and photographic technologies have changed how the Nekka Bedouin use and relate to and distribute photographs for the purpose of history making and sort of identity formation?
Excellent question. Here I really found, and you probably come across the work, but the work of Walter Armbrust and Albert Hirani, we're talking about this in the 90s when you're talking about printing, mm-hmm. just the availability of being able to mass print things. This type of, I think you see this kind of continuity of change starting to happen when it comes to representational practices and the technologies that we use to communicate this information. So social media and digital practices amongst the Bedouin are often contextualized as kind of a, at least in literature, is this non-elite form of resistance. because it allows people a platform to communicate their experiences, particularly in environments like Israel, where their narratives are sidelined or disparaged by state media. So in the Nakba, the rise of media expertise, availability amongst Bedouin members, along with the changing technologies, including mobile phones and computers, has greatly contributed to this development of alternative or wider, what I call communication ecologies throughout Southern Israel. And into these ecologies where the relationships between photography and history are being worked out, particularly with technology. As media technology and the accessibility of phones and computers become more accessible, what you're finding is younger people in particular are becoming kind of these new communicative gatekeepers of Nakba Bedouin history and the digital evidence. So today, while customary oral stories were and still are in many situations kind of the primary, not kind of, but the primary mode for communicating stories of the past in the Nakba, this representational repertoire is very controlled by the sheikhs, by the elders, by older generations of women and men. But as digital literacy and media skills increase over the last 30 years, you're finding people outside of this kind of customary cohort of historical gatekeeping, such as spokespeople from non-Asil, non-orientative backgrounds, younger academics, civic advocates, religious spokespeople from all status groups, it's much easier for them to also share knowledge of Nakba Bedouin history. And they can use kind of this authoritative assistance provided by new media, such as photographs, to validate their perspectives of this Nakba Bedouin history. So those are kind of the changes I was seeing that you're having this kind of widening of representatives of who are authorities of history and how and when they can use photographs.
But so in light of that, this is just something that I've been thinking about, and that I was thinking about a lot as I was reading your book in the context of this particular moment, you know, of what is happening in Palestine and the war on Gaza, where everything that is happening is being photographed, is being videoed, you know, is being live streamed. We have no dearth of evidence, of sort of visual evidence of what is happening. And yet it's been very easy for people, for, you know, sort of the world at large, for politicians, the media, to kind of turn a blind eye or to deny the kind of the photographed and videotaped reality of what is happening in Gaza. So I guess I kind of wonder, and I wanted to get your thoughts on this as the expert on photography, on the sort of anthropology of photography. To me, I almost wonder if there's a possibility for a kind of oversaturation of images to the point that they sort of lose their value, you know, when, like you said, when so many people, so many young people, when virtually the entire kind of Bedouin community has access to photographic technologies and can take photographs of, you know, their daily lives, and there's no kind of cost barrier to that, you know, they can pull their smartphone out of their pockets and take a photo of anything at any time. Does that make photographs sort of lose their value in a sense? Does that make us take them less seriously as forms of evidence? I don't know. I've just been wondering if there is something about the ease of photographic representation these days that means that we simply don't see photographs or videos as well, that we don't bestow the same level of importance to them as people maybe 100 years ago did. I don't know. It's a sort of half-baked thought, but just something I have really been wondering in light of what's been going on in the world both, you know, broadly in terms of the social media landscape, and also in terms of, you know, what people are calling like the first live streamed genocide, and the fact that it is live streamed and yet it is still happening. There's a kind of, seems like it should be a contradiction in terms, and yet it is not. So I just wanted to, I don't know, get your take on that.
It's a very good question. One I've been grappling with too, because I've committed so much of my academic career looking at the importance of photographs. Mm-hmm. And you're quite right with, you know, with digital technology, we're inundated. There's such an abundance of images in our lives that are embedded in everything we do, be it through social media, be it read it through news. And so it does seem to feel that they're losing their resonance, their uniqueness in that way, because it almost creates this this visual rhetoric that just gets on repeat and on loop. That, you know, it was one thing when I looked at the entangled visual economies. If you looked, you know, you typed in on Google like Palestinian Naka Bedouin, and you would scroll through the images, they were so similar about seeing the destruction of the unrecognized villages, Palestinian flags, Israeli police in full gear, and you just see these kind of visual echoes that just are so consistent. And so it was the same if you typed in Israeli Bedouin. You'd find a lot more photographs of Bedouin and the Naka having Israeli flags or what have you. And I think when you have these kind of abundant rhetoric, that it's hard to discern anymore what's important. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they just, I don't know, something to think more about as far as does their value decrease. I don't know. I do think it creates these kind of landscapes, which we just get so used to seeing images of just, you know, blown up buildings, that can we discern any, like what makes this image more important than the other image of another building doing that? So that answered your question, but it's very, definitely required more research, but yeah. I'm sure there's people out there that have written topic, especially in the sense of digital photographs. And was it Rebecca Stein wrote a book, I think, in the past couple of years, looking at visual activism. Mm-hmm. That might have insight on the topic.
Well, thank you. That's not the most optimistic or not the most uplifting note to end on, maybe. But thank you so much for coming on to speak with me and to share your research into the Naka Bedouin and the photographic landscapes of the Naka Bedouin with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. I enjoyed it.